Thanks to our sponsor, Malloy Law Offices. They are a personal injury law firm here in the local DC area that helps others recover from car accidents, work injuries, slip and fall injuries, and other types of accidents. They work on what's called a contingency fee basis. So if you hire Malloy Law Offices after an accident, then you never pay anything out of pocket. They also offer educational content and free consultations for those who have more questions than answers, like us at DC by Foot. We're really excited to partner with them next month to learn all about personal liability as a tour guide in Washington, D.C. Visit their website at malloy-law.com or call their offices at 202-335-6141. Malloy Law Offices is open 24/7, so don't hesitate to get the right legal help you need after a personal injury accident.
Land, welcome to Tour Guide Tell All. Welcome back, family. We are your friendly neighborhood, semi-neighborhood, kind of nearby tour guides from the DC area, bringing to you, as ever, some spice, some scandal, some history, some national and international intrigue. And we are back with another episode for March of 2024, which and it is March, which means it's Women's History Month. So we are going to talk about amazing women, because that's kind of how we like to roll around here. And we always like to say women's history is American history, because American history is women's history. And so we're going to do a little extra time in March to talk about the women who make our world a better place. Or sometimes not, as the case may be. But as always,
let's not, we won't put it all on the full weight of that on women's shoulders. But you know, the women who shape the world we live in, let's put it that way,
and make it certainly more interesting. Let's go with that. But as always, I'm Rebecca.
I'm Becca,
and together we are
the Rebeccas.
And today we're going to take it a little international style. We had a request from two of our very dear listeners, Stephen and Amelia, two fellow guides who we love, to do more Latinx history. And so this is our attempt, as it is, to do that. And so, Becca, what are we going to talk about?
We are going to talk today about a figure who I think culturally people have a conception of, but whose life and story have been, I think, distilled and told in so many different ways that the truth of it is probably new to a lot of people. But we're talking about a woman named Eva Perón, Eva Duarte Perón. You might know her as Evita, if you are familiar with the world of musical theater. For me, that's, I mean, I'll be straight up. I think as a kid, that's probably the first ever mention of this person I recall is the soundtrack to Andrew Lloyd Webber's big musical Evita. And through most of my, I think, you know, teen years and adulthood, most of what I knew about her came from that show. And I don't think that's unusual. I think probably for a lot of Americans and Brits too, a lot of what we know about her comes from the show, which was huge. When I was working on the outline and prepping for this episode, it was like impossible not to want to sing the songs in my head. And I promise listeners, I am not going to sing today on this episode, unless Dan can cut in Patti LuPone's voice instead of mine. there will be no singing.
I was hoping we'd get some singing.
I think it's great to kind of maybe talk about a figure like Evita, who's got these sort of this pop culture perception, and maybe peel back some of that and talk about the way in which our knowledge of her, our conception of her has been distilled through culture. And we're going to try to parse fact from fiction.
Yes.
And Eva Perón, I mean, she's a big figure. Both of us in the last few years have traveled to Argentina, to Buenos Aires. She's still holds a lot of sway. She is still somebody who is iconic. That word gets thrown out a lot, but truly is. Without delving too much into the politics of present day Argentina, it's very relevant. They have a woman in power right now who herself claims to be the modern day Eva Perón. And so her relevancy, even, you know, gosh, 70 years after her death, can't be overstated. And I think one thing the musical gets right is this idea of her as this singular icon for the Argentinian people.
I absolutely agree. And she's the only human on their money in Argentina. We put what we value on our money because it's money. And that's the most important thing. In America, we put our founding fathers and really great presidents and unfortunately all men, but that's a story for a different podcast. You have a monarch, you put the monarch on there, you know, important flora and fauna or indigenous animals or whatever it is. That's most of what Argentina has on their money is like animals and plants. She is the only human subject on their money. None of their leaders, just her. And so it's really, I think that says something really profound. She is very well remembered. There's a museum, statues in the spot where she died. Her tomb is still very visited. So she is as close to saint-like as possible, I think, in Argentina. And it's really interesting to me. We talk a lot about American myths. It's interesting to talk about like mythology from another country because you have a more outside perspective, I think, on it. And her real life is actually a little bit different. And I have some very significant quibbles with the musical, which we'll get to. But yes, I'm excited about this.
Yes. And I will, as a little bit of a spoiler, I think that there's a really interesting parallel too with as Ava grows in renown and fame, how much she models herself on an American ideal of feminine power, how much she mimics the look and style of American icons, very explicitly so. And I think that's a fascinating yes. aspect, that's the version of a woman in power that she's somewhat trying to mimic, or that's the version of feminine power she wants to have, is she looks yes. to America. And I find that very interesting to the United States. So Ava, records indicate that she was born May 7th, 1919. There are different versions of her birth certificate. There are disputes here, but the records really, we believe, May 7th, 1919 in a city in rural Argentina. So she's born about 160 miles outside of Buenos Aires. And she's born Ava Duarte. Her father, Juan Duarte, was a wealthy rancher, but Ava's mother and Ava's siblings are not his only family. This is not uncommon in the era, and certainly not uncommon in the cities, to have these sort of rural dalliances and rural families that you, as a man with some wealth, her father had. This was not unusual. However, he is going to abandon them essentially to return to his first family, his legal family, and they're left pretty much out in the cold. They're left with really nothing. They're going to be living in very poor slums. These are very, very difficult years for certainly Ava's mother to provide for her family with nothing. Despite this, Ava does have a chance to go to school. She is going to develop a love of acting and performing very early on. She'll participate in school plays and church passions. And as a young woman, she decides she wants to be an actress. This doesn't surprise me at all. If you're thinking of how do I get out of this small town, how do I get a little sense of financial stability, I think acting would be very appealing. This is the 1920s. In early 30s, that would be seen as a ticket out. So in 1934, she is 15 years old and she's going to head to Buenos Aires. There is quite a bit of dispute about why she goes there. The musical certainly indicates that she's lured away by a musician. There's certainly some argument and some evidence that she makes some connections with traveling musicians, but her mother and siblings seem to go with her. So it's very likely a family move spurred by her interest and her ability to maybe get some work. Now, I should mention the 1930s in Argentina are not too different from the 1930s in America. The Great Depression was not a uniquely American experience. There is economic distress everywhere. So the Duartes, Ava and her family, are not the only rural families coming into the cities. They're looking for jobs. They're looking for opportunity. Buenos Aires is flooded with people that are trying to find work. So they're part of this huge wave of rural Argentinians coming into the city centers, trying to find opportunity. And she's really going to kind of hit it. I mean,
she does. Buenos Aires at this time, it's the Depression, but it's also like the United States. There's a lot of cultural output happening. There's a lot of music and dance and movies. Movies are becoming cheaper to make and therefore cheaper to see. And so there's a lot of culture happening. Buenos Aires is a really happening place. They call it the Paris of South America. So it is the place to be. They're poor and these are difficult years, but it's also like she's riding a sort of movement of culture that's mimicked in the United States too.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point too about it's getting less expensive to produce music and movies and radio. As poor as you are, people have radios, and that's the primary form of kind of shared pop culture. And so there are opportunities, and she is going to kind of hit. She's going to take any acting job she can get. Stage, radio, film. She's going to dye her naturally dark hair platinum blonde, which, hello, that is very much mimicking the style of the American screen actresses of the time. This is what Jean Harlow looks like, right? Everything's very blonde, very specific kind of look. And so she and other young actresses in Argentina are mimicking that very like Hollywood blonde style. And she's going to keep that look for the rest of her life. She has her biggest success on the radio, kind of doing radio plays and radio dramas. She actually ends up ultimately co-owning a radio company that she works for. And by the time we get to the early 1940s, she is one of the highest paid radio actresses in Argentina. She has done quite well for herself in this pursuit. I mean, she's a workhorse. She works constantly, but she's managed to build up quite a reputation. She is going to move to the Recoleta, which is one of the more upscale neighborhoods in Buenos Aires. And this is going to start connecting her a little bit more into the society world, which she's not a part of. She, because of the background of her birth, because of kind of the fact that she's made her money and success, she's not fully integrated into society, but she's now sort of living among them and starting to dabble a little bit into philanthropy and starting to mix and mingle a little bit more with politicians. Which brings us to the man that will ultimately become her husband, Juan Perón.
Juan Perón. So on January 15th, 1944, an earthquake hits the town of San Juan, killing 10,000 people. This is a big disaster. It's really terrible. And Juan Perón is the Secretary of Labor for the government at the time. And he is going to fundraise to help the victims. And so he has this big fundraiser at a gala about a week later on the 22nd of January. And they invite, you know, all kinds of notable people to come and headline this event and, you know, donate their time so that people will donate money to help these victims. And it is at this gala that Juan Perón and Eva Duarte first lay eyes on each other. She will later refer to this day as her marvelous day, which I love. They hit it off immediately and are going to leave the gala together. So they become an item like real fast. So Juan Perón, just to give a little bit of background about him, he had been in the military. He had been much better off growing up than Eva Duarte had. He had then transitioned sort of later in life to politics and was at that point the Secretary of Labor, but has ambitions for a higher office. He is also 48 to her 24. So there is a significant age difference, and he is a widower. So his first wife died of cancer a few years prior, and him and Eva Duarte basically hit it off. And this is my first big, like, there's a lot of talk. Like, if your only exposure to Eva Perón is the musical Evita, it gives you the impression that she schemes her way into his bed. And I find I have feelings about that characterization, and I think it's not fair. First of all, it's really deeply misogynist, and they kind of give you the impression that Eva Perón, or Eva Duarte, as she was, that she sort of serially dates men that will help her career and sort of dumps them, and that Juan Perón is like the apex of her social climbing. And that may be true. It wouldn't be the first time, right? But Juan Perón also has a lot to gain by being with her as well, and not just the fact that she's lovely and much younger. Juan Perón is older and military. Eva Perón represents a different class of people, a lot of young people. She has a wide audience being on the radio, and she doesn't come from the political world. So she has the ear of a lot of different people that he's not, really doesn't have an audience with. And so for him, there's an advantage for him in being with her as well, apart from just the advantage of being with a much younger woman. The other thing that if you watch the musical, it gives you kind of the impression, or at least I got the impression, that Juan Perón's kind of an idiot, that he's like a dupe, right? That she like dupes him. And he was not a dumb man. He wasn't a good guy, as we'll kind of get to in a bit, but he wasn't a dumb man. So if he knew she was using him, he was smart enough to figure that out. He didn't care. And I'm a little bit of a romantic here. I like to actually believe it seems from all the evidence I could find that they had genuine affection for each other, that this genuinely was a love match. And he remains devoted to her for the rest of her life. It may have been that they kind of saw a political advantage in being together. And I'm not saying that's true, but I also think more than one thing can be possible in a relationship like this. I think they both got what they wanted and needed. And I actually do think they had some affection for each other. So that's going to be my thing about Wampirim.
I think that's exactly right. I'm so glad you said more than one thing can be true.
Yes.
One is absolutely that I think they both benefit from this match.
Yes.
They both have things they want. They are both deeply ambitious people. And you see that paralleled in their careers up to this point. I mean, Ava shows up in Buenos Aires at 15 with nothing. And by 24, she's the most highly paid radio actress. That doesn't happen without ambition, without hard work, without, right, you know, conniving, manipulation, whatever you want to call it. To get that far, you make it happen. Mm-hmm. Juan Perón, who enters the National Military College at 16, works his way up through just every level of the military. I do want to mention he studied mountain warfare in the Italian Alps in 1939. Just clock that year for later. He has a chance to see people like Mussolini and Hitler up close. He really observes Europe right in the early years of the Second World War. He had already, by the time he met Ava, been part of one military coup in Argentina, which is how he gets the post of the Department of Labor. So this is a man who has orchestrated moving to where he is in his career. I have no doubt that he also is very considerate and thoughtful and orchestrating who's going to be his next partner. But I think more than one thing can be true. Mm-hmm. I think they truly had affection and attraction for each other. I also think they both immediately clock how they can benefit each other. Because he is an ambitious man. His first wife has died, and she dies at the age of 36. She's quite young. And he has used this time as Secretary of Labor to take what used to be a nothing job. Department of Labor at the time in Argentina was where you dumped the guy you didn't want to deal with. And he took this unimportant job and he used it to build relationships with labor workers, to pass what were fairly progressive social reforms to improve working conditions and to increase his influence among sort of the second tier of military leaders. So he's building a coalition and he's building a support base, and then he meets this powerhouse. And so it is, I love that she calls it that my marvelous like moment. It's so beautiful and so lovely, but also it is marvelous in that they have each found what they need to continue to move forward in their lives. And I think they're fairly equally matched when it comes to ambition, for sure.
Yes. The American figure I would actually most compare him to, not in terms of his politics, but in terms of how he kind of goes into government, takes a small role, makes it bigger, is Herbert Hoover. Like Herbert Hoover had this totally separate career and then becomes Secretary of Commerce and really expands the role, angling to become president, which he does obviously become. So Juan Perón is kind of like this. There is a darker side to Juan Perón too. Like Argentinian politics is very different, and we're not going to parse the ins and outs of this, but he is really left in some ways, but super duper right in other ways. He openly aligns with fascists. He's anti-Semitic. And spoiler, after the war is over and he becomes president, he's going to make Argentina a friendly place for people to come to. There's a reason that the joke is that Germans after the war go to Argentina. He's part of that. And so there is a darker side to Juan Perón that definitely need to be mentioned. And he also will claim that he selected her as his pupil. So to bring it back to Eva Perón, he will claim in his memoir, because of course he writes a political memoir, that he selected her. And the musical makes you think like she selects him. So it's sort of this mutual, I feel like it must have been so interesting to see them like these two like stars like collide when they met and like sparks shatter everywhere. So they become a couple very quickly. She is going to be elected. There's only one union allowed to be in Argentina at that time, and it is a broadcast performers. And she becomes president of this union while she's dating Juan Perón. And it seemed as this, she begins a daily program. She talks about how great he is. And this, you know, she's kind of hopping up her boyfriend on her daily radio program. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Yeah, to be clear, there are multiple unions in Argentina at the time, all of which are government mandated, though. So they're unions, but they're all formed by the government. And there's only one allowed for radio performers. So when radio performers go, where's our union? They form one, but there's only the one. And twist, they all vote for Ava, the girlfriend of the Secretary of Labor, to be the president of their union. So she gets to sort of slip in there by virtue of having this connection. And her radio program is called Toward a Better Future, which sounds like a campaign slogan, right? Toward a better future. And every day she uses the soap opera format of this show to basically talk about how she, an ordinary woman, a rural girl who's come to the big city and found success. It's because of Perón's leadership and because of his programs and because of what he's done as Secretary of Labor. And so it's this nice little piece of propaganda that they get to put out every single day that's endorsed essentially by the Radio Performers Union. And so we see immediately how they're becoming this power couple and how they're able to bolster each other. Without getting into the nitty-gritty of what's happening in the Argentinian politics and military of this time, there's a lot of jostling that's happening. You've got a power vacuum. You've got people who are all trying to kind of figure out where they fit. And even though Perón had been part of the move that forced the resignation of President Pedro Ramírez, who's the president he served under as Secretary of Labor, he's part of this push to get him out. And he does this in order to help put his friend at the time, Eldemiro Farrell, in power. As soon as Farrell becomes president, he's real wary of Perón because it's like, all right, well, you are on my side right now, but now I'm in the hot seat. Now I'm in the power and I don't trust you. And I don't trust that you're building up this huge base of support. I don't love that every day people turn into the radio and hear how great you are. And Farrell immediately kind of goes, I guess if you were going to displace one guy, you might want to displace me. And so on October 1945, President Farrell has Perón arrested. And 6 days later, outside the Casa Rosada, which is where the president lives, hundreds of thousands of people gather to demand for the release of Juan Perón. Now, in his memoir, he will write a very fictionalized version of the events. And in his version, long after the fact, Ava was knocking on the streets of the doors in the city, going house to house to house, and personally rallying thousands of people to come and demonstrate for him. That's not at all how this plays out. This is organized by labor groups and unions. And of course, Ava is there and she speaks out against Perón's arrest on the radio, but she's not the one bringing the people there. But I think it's telling that that's how he writes it, right? The role he believes she played. And I think it really points to how significant he understands her symbolism and her mythology to be, that the people want to believe this about her and believe that the two of them are so closely intertwined. Yeah, he's arrested, but 6 days later, everybody's out there protesting for his release. And so indeed, he is released from prison. What can President Farrell do? Nothing.
And the day after he's released, on the 18th of October, 1945, he marries her in a civil ceremony. They later have a big church wedding. He talks about that he was so moved by her loyalty that she stuck with him while he was in prison through all this turmoil and marries her. The other reason, I think, is that he wants to run for president. And just like anywhere else, it's better if you have a wife rather than a girlfriend when you're running for president. This is still the 40s. She is still considerably younger. And so I feel like there's a little bit of realpolitik in here too. So he runs for president. She's a very big part of his campaign and he wins.
It's not surprising to me, right? I mean, she's a very gifted speaker. She's a performer. So she's great at this. She's great being on the radio for him, using her radio shows. Again, this is all very propagandist. She's using what's supposed to be a free and independent radio show to constantly campaign for him. But she's wonderful. She's lovely. She's young. She brings youth and vigor. She has this connection to the descamisados, the everyday people of Argentina. And so there's no qualms about it. She is the face of this campaign. And his willingness to sort of see it as a partnership and recognize her benefit, I think, is fascinating. As much as there's that machismo in the culture, he has no hesitation about putting her exactly where she needs to be to help this campaign.
No, I think that's real. And he makes it her a central role in his government. In fact, to this day, you know, just like in the US, every Argentine head of state has their portrait painted. We do the same thing. He is to this day the only Argentine leader with their spouse in the picture with them. And that is not something any president has yet done. They don't get pictured with their spouse. He does. And so he really recognizes how valuable she is, how important she is, and that this is in so many ways a partnership, that she's in this with him, that they're doing this together. And she does a lot of really great work as First Lady of Argentina. She starts a society of beneficence. She's really concerned, as you might imagine, with women and children, with the poor. There's a charitable organization that she basically focuses on, and it starts to receive government funding.
Yeah. So as First Lady, she's going to take a very active public role. I think it's important to mention that everything's very muddy in the way the Argentinian government is set up at this time. There's a lot of money flowing in and out, and a lot of things that aren't officially government are government, you know what I'm saying? So there had been this group, the Society of Beneficence, the Sociedad de Beneficia de Buenos Aires, and it was a charitable organization that went all the way back to the 1800s. It was primarily focused on caring for women and orphans. Mm-hmm. While it was originally founded on charitable donations from individuals, by the 20th century, it is the kind of official recipient of government mm-hmm. funding. And by the time we get to the time that Ava is First Lady, it is headed up by 87 women. These are primarily the wives of wealthy men and expats in Argentina. These are, you know, the women married to the heads of manufacturing firms and the leaders of business. And these are exactly the kind of women that are a little hesitant about Ava. She is not like them, right? She's come into this position in a very different way. And traditionally, the society would elect the First Lady as the charity president. But when Ava becomes First Lady, they do not. They choose to not have her become president. And they basically try to ice her out, which is really dumb. It's stupid.
Seems like a snub.
It's so many levels, right? Like, first of all, she's clearly very powerful and very prestigious. She is the First Lady. Your funding comes from the government. And he's clearly a wife guy. He's so loyal to her.
Right?
It's so dumb. And officially, they will just say she's too young. But this is meant to be an insult to her. It's meant to be an insult to Perón. And wouldn't you know it, not too long after, the government's going to cut its funding to the society and basically direct it to a new charity. Because twist, right at the same time this happened, Ava decides to start the Ava Perón Foundation.
Huh. How about that?
So it's so savvy on her part to respond this way. I mean, she doesn't like force her way in. She doesn't engage in a long fight. She goes, oh, you don't want me to be head of your society, your charity? Cool. I'll start one and we'll see how that works out for you. But I think it speaks to how there's some truth to this in the musical. And I think some truth to this in the reality of the Perones have forced themselves in a little bit, right? They've gotten to this position through sheer force of will. And not everybody's just going to step aside and be okay with that. We see that in the way that Perón has to jostle with the military. And this on the society side is, you know, Ava has to deal with these snubs. And so she starts her foundation, which seems like a really, you know, good idea. The founding charter says, quote, in the sole hands of its founder, who will possess the widest powers afforded by the state and the Constitution. So this is basically Ava's world and you're just living in it, right? She is going to get money from the government to spend and dole out as she sees fit. Now, to be fair, she starts this with 10,000 pesos of her own money, but eventually the foundation will have 3 billion pesos. So, that's a little bit of seed money for what grows into a giant thing. Now, here's the thing about the government funding. It's not Juan Perón necessarily who decides to put all this money in. That comes from Congress, but Congress is controlled by Perónists, by members of his party and supporters. And there is a fair bit of political and social pressure to stay on the good side of the First Lady. So Congress is going to pass a lot of bills directing money into the fund, but also on an individual level, you're going to feel a little maybe obligated to give. Trade unions are also a huge supporter of the foundation. They see Ava as their biggest ally. They see her as their conduit to Perón and to stay on Perón's good side. This also foundation gets the official backing of the Catholic Church. So you have your bishops and your diocese encouraging people to give. And then in 1950, Congress passes a law declaring that a portion of every lottery ticket, every cinema ticket, and any gambling game goes into the foundation. So this becomes the one place in the government where almost all charitable money is flowing.
It's impressively successful too, as you might imagine, given all of the money that's flowing in the support. It's going to employ 14,000 people. It distributes 500,000 sewing machines and pairs of shoes and 200,000 cooking pots annually. So it's giving people what they need. It's giving them money to survive. It builds dozens of hospitals, orphanages, schools, housing projects, all sorts of things in obviously Buenos Aires, but all throughout the country. And Eva Perón is the public face of this foundation that bears her name. She will go out and distribute things herself, goes out and gives out food to people and opens up apartments and hospital complexes and does the sort of red carpet event, very much like a royal would, like the ceremonial opening and groundbreaking and distributing food at food banks and things like that. So she's going to be very visible. And of course, she does not miss an opportunity to have this put in the press, right? There's a lot of this, like, charity is great and everyone should do it. And I don't want to impugn her motives because she is helping real people, but she also does not miss an opportunity to make sure that her good deeds go into the newspaper, that go into the on the radio. So it is, she's being seen to do these things, which is as important almost as her doing them. And so this is going to give her the aura of saintliness. She's helping everybody. She's giving people what they need. She's giving them money and food and security. This feeds right into her mystique, I guess.
Yeah, right. I mean, she becomes, it's like the mother, right? The mother of the nation. She's going out and handing out money and supplies and opening hospitals, and she's there every day. And a cynic might also point to this and say, she's there to remind everybody that this good fortune comes from Perón. And so if you want the good times to keep rolling, he's got to stay in power. So if you had a somewhat cynical view of politics, right, there is a sense of, if you like being on the receiving end of this, we're the ones doing it and you have us to thank, because it's very clear who it's coming from and who's supporting this. But you cannot, I think, dispute the actual just sheer amount of work that the foundation does. However, yes, I think it's important to note the intense pressure to give to this foundation. It's not official, but you got to kind of do it. There's one really kind of famous circumstance of a particular factory, a manufacturer of candy and sweets, which was shut down by the government for several weeks after they refused to donate goods to the foundation. So there becomes a little bit of this strong arming that if you aren't going to be willing to give, you know, the government may make it really, really obvious that you have to. The other aspect of this, and I will say this is an area where not only I think the musical does a disservice, but some of the earliest books written about her claim that there were no financial records. They claim that all this money went into Swiss bank accounts. There's no evidence of that. However, the financial records for the foundation were all kept under the purview of the Ministry of Finance, which is under the purview of Perón. This is Perón's administration. And during his time in office, the Ministry of Finance does not have a reputation per se for honesty or ethics. So I think it's worth noting you've got billions of pesos coming in, you've got plenty of stuff going out, and ultimately the person who gets to decide is the first lady. There's very little check on who gets to decide who benefits from this. And probably very likely, I'd imagine, when it comes to which companies and which things get to, you know, get the contracts and do these things, I'm sure, as in any political system, you've got some backdoor dealing going on. But at the end of the day, this foundation is her passion. She spends some days 20 hours a day working on programs. She spends a good portion of her time and energy traveling around. A lot of the outreach is into the rural communities. So she might spend a whole day traveling out to hand out supplies, you know, do ribbon cuttings, you know, glad hand, and then come back in. So this is really how she's spending a bulk of her time, at least in country.
Yes. And then she goes on a big tour. She goes on what they call the Rainbow Tour of Europe. And it's billed as a goodwill tour, i.e. non-political, but like, let's be real, she's clearly going over there for politics. It originally was supposed to be the Spanish leader, Franco at the time, is going to extend an invitation to her husband for a sort of state visit. And at that time, it was difficult to fly over there. So he would have had to take a boat and it would have been a longer trip. And he doesn't want to be away that long. So Eva Perón decides that if her husband's not going to do it, she will. And so she is going to go. She's at this point, Argentina is improving its relationships with a lot of different countries around the world. And she is seen as sort of an ambassador for this effort. She goes to visit Franco and Antonio Salazar, who's the dictator of Portugal at the time. And this is going to be frowned on because Franco, not a great guy. Also Salazar, not really great. Dictators aren't great. These are like the two last Western European dictators in power. And she goes to visit them. And it just, the optics are not really great of her like heading over to sort of embrace and put her arms around these really authoritarian leaders.
Yeah, the idea is sort of Argentina had just recently joined the United Nations. The thought was like, let's send Eva. It'll be so much softer. And even if she meets with these questionable leaders, well, they won't hold it against us as much because it's just the first lady and blah, 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 blah. But it just doesn't look good, right? Mm. It really does. And it doesn't look good in light of Perón's own politics and the way in which he's running Argentina. And yeah. So it's supposed to start off great. They're going to Spain where they are, or she's going to Spain where she's welcomed very warmly. Franco gives her the highest civilian decoration, the Order of Isabella the Catholic. But the response from the press outside of Spain is not so great. It's sort of, what are you doing over there with those two guys?
Yeah. What's going on there, huh?
We don't love it.
Don't love it. As she then goes to Rome, where she is received by the Pope. She's allowed the time that's usually allotted for queens. He's given her a rosary. She goes to France and meet with Charles de Gaulle. And then while she's in France, she hears that the king, King George VI, is not interested in receiving her when she plans to go to Britain. And she takes this as a snub, which I think indeed it was. And she cancels the trip to the UK. She gives the official reason is exhaustion, but you know. Let's be real here.
Yeah, the idea that the British, not only would King George not receive her, but that the British government would not recognize it as any sort of official state visit feels very delegitimizing. You can imagine, right, that is a snub. I mean, there's no other way around it. And she has I think, a fair reason to call exhaustion. It is exhausting. And as we'll talk about in a little bit, she has some reasons maybe for being exhausted. But then she tries to wrap it up in Switzerland. And that really doesn't go great because you show up in Switzerland and there are accusations about why she's there. This is where, you know, the talk of secret Swiss bank accounts comes from. And so it's probably a good idea they cut it short. But for Eva, it's really eye-opening. It shows certainly where Argentina fits into this world, which is uncertain. She thought that she might learn lessons from post-war Europe on how to deal with poverty and many of the issues that are impacting the world after the Second World War. She's very disillusioned. She's disillusioned by what she sees in these countries. She's disillusioned both by what's happening in places like Spain under Franco and by these supposedly free and independent places like France. She really doesn't feel like any of them are doing right by the poor. And in fact, it reaffirms her belief that most programs developed or administered by the wealthy don't actually benefit the poor at all. She would give a quote that has become sort of one of her signatures, which is, when the rich think about the poor, they have poor ideas. And she really comes back reinvigorated for her foundation with the idea that she knows best, having been poor, having been on the front lines. She knows way better what the government can do to help. One of the other areas where she's really quite progressive is when it comes to women's suffrage. She is an outspoken supporter of the idea that women should vote. And this is something she repeatedly brings up in her radio program. She would do radio addresses. She goes to suffrage events in support of the Argentine women's right to vote. And this is something that happens while Perón's in office. So when he runs for president in 1946, women couldn't vote. And when he becomes president, this becomes something that is going to pick up movement. And during his time, the Perón-backed Congress will pass this law. And when he signs the bill into law, he actually hands it over to Eva, and he really sort of heralds her as the driving force behind. Now, I don't want to discredit the work that many women on the ground had done for this. The labor unions were very supportive of women's suffrage as well. But it's, I think, really telling that this happens during Eva's time in the public spotlight.
Yes. She also creates the Female Peronist Party, the first female political party in the country. By 1951, the party has 500,000 members and 3,600 headquarters across the country. It is a huge base of support for her husband. And it comes at exactly the right time because he's going to run for re-election. And there's a question about who his vice president's going to be. He's obviously going to be president, but there is talk about who should be vice president. And the talk is that it should be her. And there is a huge popular movement to sort of draft her, I guess, as his vice president. She's popular with women and working class, particularly the working class, labor unions. There is a big rally in Buenos Aires on August 22nd to show support for her as vice president. And there are pictures of it. The two of them are pictured side by side, these massive pictures in downtown Buenos Aires. And she gives a speech, and it's called the renunciation, because she is going to, basically declines publicly to run at this time for political office, that she is happy being the woman who brings out the hopes and dreams of the people to its president. And she throws herself on the idea that she is happy being the people's voice and being their sort of voice in the administration, but is not going to run for re-election. And this is how you know that she is really sick at this time, because I think that's not the real reason she didn't want to run for vice president. As we're going to talk about in more depth in a minute, she was extremely ill by this time and just did not have the ability, the stamina, the health, the whatever it was. And the strong suspicion is that she did, just knowing how ill she was, declines for that reason. That had she not been ill, she would have run.
Or truly, if it had even been 2 or 3 years earlier and the depths of her illness had not been so evident. But by 51, as you said, it's clear to anyone close to her who's seeing her up close that she is in very, very bad straits. But again, I think it's fascinating that not only is there this popular movement, Perón publicly supports the idea of his wife being vice president. This is something he talks about with advisors. This is something he very much, you know, if it's the will of the people, it's what he wants. And the fact that she gives this speech, I think, is very, very clear that there is a real reason, which is that she's quite ill. Her health had not been good. I mean, really, from the time she becomes first lady, she is not in good health. That's partially why I think the exhaustion excuse for the Rainbow Tour in 47 isn't fully to cover up the fact that she's been sort of embarrassed on the national stage by the British. But truly, she had started to sort of lose some of her stamina and speed. By the time we get to 1950, she's had a series of public fainting spells. She's had to leave events. She's had to be carried out of places. And after one of these particularly public fainting incidents, she undergoes surgery for highly advanced cervical cancer. We're talking stage 4. Very, very, very advanced. She did withhold almost all of that medical reality from the Argentinian people and did as much as she could to hide the reality from her husband.
He knew she was sick, like he could see it. And Juan Perón has lost his first wife to cervical cancer. And they didn't know this at the time, and you can't blame him, but cervical cancer is caused by an STD that she got and his first wife got from him. So he recognizes what's happening. He's seen it. And I think that even if she tried to withhold her diagnosis, I think he kind of had the sense that things were not really good. She is extremely unwell. After this renunciation speech, she's going to undergo a hysterectomy by an American. She actually goes to try to remove the tumor. It is too far advanced at this point. It has metastasized and gone to other parts of her body. And it is very clear that she does not have long to live. She actually becomes the first Argentinian to undergo chemotherapy, but all it really does is make her extremely skinny and doesn't really do much to knock out the cancer. There's evidence to suggest that many years later, a neurosurgeon looks at her skull x-rays and says that it's possible that she was given a prefrontal lobotomy in the last months of her life to relieve the pain and agitation that she suffers in the final months. But it returns very rapidly. And by June of 1952, she's only 80 pounds. Like, she has dropped a ton of weight. And part of this is because she doesn't really stop her political activity. Her husband's running for re-election, and she wants to be on the forefront of this and refuses to concede any ground to this illness that she cannot avoid.
Yeah, I mean, even though she knows she's gone through these surgeries, she's tried chemo, all of this, she just continues to push and push and push and push to be as much of a public face for him as she can be. On May 7th, 1952, her birthday, Perón grants her the title of spiritual leader of the nation. This sort of gives her this special designation. And he wins re-election in June of 52. Shortly thereafter, he's going to celebrate with this big parade through Buenos Aires, and she basically doses herself up. And I mean, truly, yeah, doses up on all the pain meds she can take while staying like somewhat cognizant. And she has a frame, a wooden frame built into her fur coat so that she can be a part of this parade, so that she can be propped up beside him. She is not going to let him be alone for this re-election celebration.
And there are pictures of this. Mm. And she looks drawn, like she looks like you can tell she's gritting through it, but she's in this massive fur coat and you can tell she just doesn't quite fill it out. And so it's this really sort of agonizing moment. She takes a bunch of pain pills to make it through the parade. And then when she gets back afterwards, she takes a bunch more. And it is very clear that the end is close to anyone who is really like intimately connected with her. In fact, she dies not even 2 months after this. Like, she is really at the end of her life. She dies young, age of 33, on the 26th of July, 1952. And is immediately widely mourned. The mourning lasts for days. The government suspends all official activities. The nation, people flood to Argentina to observe her coffin. She lies in state. The flags are flown at half mast for 10 days. Just is a huge, immense outpouring of grief. Its flowers are left everywhere. 2,000 people would be treated for injuries, and several would die while they're trying to get close to her coffin as it's moving around Buenos Aires.
Yeah. And Buenos Aires itself runs out of flowers in the first day after her death. Like, there are no florist shops, no groceries, no farm stands. They run out, and there actually will be floral shortages throughout the next 10 days as people are flooding into the city, desperate to leave their mementos and their marks. So I think it's really hard to overstate the reaction to her death. In this country, everybody wants to be close to her. Everybody wants to be there. Perón is devastated, the head of state, and he is going to do everything he can to give her the full backing of the government. She's going to have a state funeral despite not being a head of state. And there is, I think, something to be said too of this is very much legitimate, but there is also a lot of encouragement and pressure from the government and production of this, right? A lot of this is a production. He wants to make sure that this stays in the forefront of Argentinians' mind for as long as possible. So as much as they can drag this out, they do, because he knows he's lost one of his most important assets.
Yes.
And you know, the more that people associate him with her, the better he feels it will be for him in this second term of his presidency.
I do think the mourning is sincere. I think it is very, like, there's a lot, like, they run out of flowers. The comparison that inevitably jumps to mind for any elder millennial is Princess Diana's death. It's really just the flowers are everywhere. Millions of people, nearly 3 million people come to Argentina to sort of bear witness as her funeral is going on. At that moment, she dies in it's the summer in our hemisphere, but the dead of winter in Argentina, and the Summer Olympics are happening in Finland. And the Argentinian team actually sets up, because they can't go home, they actually set up a memorial service for the athletes who are in Helsinki for the games. So it's a huge, there's a public viewing, like it's this really intense production, and the state funeral is really a lot. And they make plans for a big memorial for her.
They say it'll be bigger than the Statue of Liberty,
which is a lot.
And the idea was that they would keep her displayed forever for the public, just like Lenin.
Oh no. Oh dear.
Which is a lot. And the memorial never gets built, but her body was displayed publicly for almost 2 years. So while they never actually get around to building this larger than life one, they do publicly display her for 2 years. And I'll agree with you. I think a lot of the mourning is absolutely sincere. I should say the pageantry and the production of this is very calculated, I think, by Perón and his government.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. I'll put a little clarity there on that thought, but that he's well aware that he has lost his trump card, as it's said in the musical, but his greatest asset, right? And he wants to do whatever he can. And he has reason to be concerned. Perón, who again, is not a great guy, is thrown out of power in 1955, and he flees so quickly to get out of the country. He doesn't have time to deal with her body. And then her body disappears for 16 years. During this time, there is a ban in the country on Perónism. A lot of public acknowledgement of her is taken down, removed. There's sort of, if you had those, like, as you could imagine, many people I think of with the picture of John F. Kennedy in their home, right? If you had those pictures of the Peróns, you had to take them down. And so there's sort of this ban on Perónism. And it's sort of this question of where did she go? Where did they put her or take her? And there's a lot of fear that she's been lost forever. She was not lost forever. In 1971, her body is found in a crypt in Milan, Italy.
Amazing.
Under a different name. And it is flown to Spain to be reunited with Juan Perón, because he's still alive in 1971, living in exile in Spain. And Rebecca, what does he do with her?
What does he do with her? This is creepy, kids. Buckle up. He keeps her displayed in his dining room.
Which I think we should mention, he's remarried at this point to his third wife, Isabel.
Yep, he gets remarried. He keeps her in his living room. And then literally a year later, he runs for president again and wins. So he has this like triumphal return back to Buenos Aires, becomes president again with his third wife at his side, and brings Eva's body back with him. He doesn't live long. He is president for about a year and dies. And then in an even surprising more twist, his third wife, Isabel, takes over as president, sort of in his name, and borrows sort of from his legacy. And she has him displayed in public with her, with Eva, their bodies displayed together, which again is creepy. And then eventually they're actually laid to rest in very separate tombs. Isabel apparently does not want to spend eternity with her husband's second wife. And Isabel actually, as of the taping of this podcast, is still alive. She's living in exile in Spain in her 90s. But Juan Perón is buried in Buenos Aires, and Eva is buried in a different cemetery, the famous Recoleta Cemetery at the Duarte family tomb. So she is buried with her father, her siblings, and the Recoleta is a really gorgeous cemetery. If you're in Buenos Aires, could not recommend enough. It's massive. And if I knew more about Argentinian history, I would appreciate it probably a lot more. But everybody who goes there goes to the Duarte tomb, because that's where Eva is. There were fresh flowers. There was a long line. It is a very big and significant deal to this day to go and pay respects to Eva Perón. So that's where her sort of, after all this movement, that's kind of where she ends up. There is also in Buenos Aires, at this palace that she dies in, it's called the Unzo Palace. It was torn down after Perón was kicked out of power. And there is sort of more lately a statue of her. It is not the size of the Statue of Liberty. It is very tasteful and very lovely. And she's reaching out to help the poor in the spot where the palace was. And then in the 70s, her reputation is rescued, I kind of want to say with a caveat, by Andrew Lloyd Webber and turned into the musical Evita. And you should see it. It's really great. It does not always paint her in the best light, but watching Evita, you need somebody who's got some singing chops, I tell you what, because it is a part. Like, it is, you need range for this part. But it is a slightly more misogynist take on her than I would perhaps enjoy, but it is really good.
We really should have like a special bonus, and you can hear our unfiltered thoughts on the musical of Evita. But one thing that Andrew Lloyd Webber does, I think, is sort of solidify, right, this legacy for this woman, particularly outside of her home country. Again, I think for many Americans and for many Brits, it's the first exposure you get to her and her story. And this, I think, on its surface, it's originally created as a rock album, kind of this sort of rock concert opera album. So the idea is sort of this, mostly the songs will tell the story. And then I think so much of how it can be staged and presented can really help you understand Eva Duarte and then Eva Peron in really unique ways. But it's definitely worth checking out. I don't know if I can wholeheartedly, full-throatedly endorse the musical version, the movie musical adaptation with Madonna, but it's worth if it's your only way in, maybe worth checking out and getting a little sense of what this time period was like and a little sense of the trajectory of Ava's life. But certainly, I think we have to give the musical props for shining a light and definitely, I think, putting the story out here now in a way that generation after generation, people can kind of keep turning to Eva and her story. And that's Eva Peron. I didn't sing once.
You didn't sing once.
It was an accomplishment.
Maybe there'll be a bonus where she'll sing, guys. Maybe if we talk about the musical, she'll sing.
Absolutely not. Thank you guys so much, as always, for coming along with us. We appreciate you so much. Huge shout out and thank you to our patrons. You will have a patron only episode this month, so buckle in, patrons. And if you're not a patron, you can always join. There's never a limit to when you can sign up, and when you sign up, you'll get access to that archive of patron only episodes. Thank you again, as always. If you have questions, ideas, comments, feedback, you can find us on social media, tourguidetell all, in all the usual places, and you can email us tourguidetellall@gmail.com. Thank you guys so much, and we will see you next time in April.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.